yes, of course. Burl Baron. I've known a few writers who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
Ladies and gentlemen, live from the supply beautific hills of Encino, California, where industry and nature work hand in hand to create a better life for all of us, the following program is produced by Magic Matt Allen on the Outlaw Radio Network. True Crime Uncensored, I am the legendary Burl Bear, Howard Lapidus, manager to the star. He actually has more than one star, maybe one and a half. Fact checker Mark Boyer, and our special guest, a man who knew enough to make a fortune in true crime and get the hell out, Lowell Caulfield, author of one of the most famous books in the history of true crime, a New York Times bestseller, House of Secrets. How many printings is this thing in now?
I think we're up to around 20 right now.
Whew, that's amazing. Those checks just keep coming in the mail, and who could complain? Pleasure to have you here. Man from Detroit, Ann Arbor, Michigan. Can't make up your mind where you're from. Were you from Detroit or Ann Arbor?
Originally from Detroit, and now live in Los Angeles.
Well, it's a wise move.
I needed to get to La La Land to get away from all the drama of true crime. Yeah. Not to the land of make-believe.
Yeah, it's safer in the land of make-believe than it is in the land of true crime.
Absolutely.
I even had cops come to my house once when I was doing an investigation on a case. Never investigate a case in your own hometown. The cops get a little bit testy. Howard, good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you, too. That was a where did you write?
Howard,
did you write?
Howard eat before?
I always eat during.
Chocolate chip cookies on true crime.
This is part of how I do it.
Yes, this is
I
how we do it.
I open by chewing a cookie, and then I address the elephant in the room.
Okay, what's the elephant?
Casey Anthony. If we're going to talk about true crime, if you can't get enough of that case this week on television and how it relates to our guest in his book to a certain extent, when we get back to just gruesome lying stuff.
Well, we had Diane Fanning who wrote the book.
I know.
But that's an ongoing case, and that's really bizarre.
Yeah, but it's they're trying the case right now. I've never seen a case where the lying has been just compounded upon compounded upon compounded.
It's pretty spectacular. Well, you know what I'm struck by is the coverage of the case and how little a lot of the people, particularly on the cable news networks, know about criminal pathology as they comment about, her and what she is and what maybe her diagnosis is.
So what do you think?
Narcissistic personality disorder. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily a psychopath.
No, she doesn't have the psychopath symptoms from what I've seen.
But definitely narcissistic.
A sociopath?
No. Narcissistic personality disorder.
That's it? Yeah. Just that?
Well, there's like five personality disorders. Narcissistic, psychopath, histrionic, borderline, a few others like that. She's a classic narcissist.
Yeah, Dr. Lillian Glast is running body language commentary on the case, pointing out that she's got this crumpled up piece of tissue held for her tears that are never there.
Yeah.
she's wiping away the imaginary tears with a perfectly dry Kleenex.
She cried yesterday.
She finally did.
She cried when they showed the photos of the corpse in the ground. It's basically the skeletal corpse, and with a tape around the mouth,
right,
and the heart on the tape.
The interesting thing is that she never cried when they showed pictures of her and the child, and the kind of nice pictures. The narcissist, the only pain they feel are their own pain. They don't have the empathy for the pain of others, and so I'm sure when she was looking at that skull, she was thinking, hell, this is what got me into all this.
If it hadn't been for this dead body, I wouldn't be in trouble today.
That's right, exactly. I mean, she wouldn't have any, she didn't seem to have any particularly natural motherly emotions, about seeing her and her daughter together in happier times. And the party pictures are just going to lay her out. I mean, they're doing the hot body contest.
It's really stellar. Bizarre. This is within 30 days that the girl was missing.
Yeah, actually, just a couple of days. A hot body contest.
It's
just stellar.
Not the dead body contest, mind you, the hot body contest.
Stellar, criminal pathology. Yeah, amazing.
Well, these things do have an impact, not only on the participants, but on the people who write the books. Now, you were telling me, and we might as well tell the audience, the book House of Secrets is like in its 20th printing. It's been around a long time, New York Times bestseller. You almost didn't write this, did you?
Well, up to that time, I think I'd done 5 or 4 true crime books before that. And before that, I was a reporter in Detroit, covering a lot of crime in Detroit. And Detroit, of course, is like a theme park for crime. You know, it's a great innovator of, youth selling drugs, carjacking. They've contributed a lot in the entrepreneurial efforts of criminal behavior. And I was a pretty hardened guy. I mean, there, I would say a detachment to it. And that continued when I did books, and then I got, actually my editor told me at Kensington told me about this book, and the setup is a family of 13 goes on a cross-country crime spree, a couple of people are dead, whatever. It looked kind of easy, but it resulted in 2 years of research with it involved incest, murder, torture of children, abuse of children, patricide. You name it.
What was your key in? What when you started to see this case? What was the first thing you said, and then led to all the other things?
Well, the patriarch of the family had gone on trial in Florida for ordering the murder of his own grandson, and. And there was some evidence that, in fact, that it was his son as well as his grandson. In other words, he'd been having sex with his daughter. And I thought it was a little twisted, and because it was twisted, it might be it might be easier to write. And I'd broken some ground in true crime books before. When I first started writing true crime, the only kind of true crime books that sold were rich people who committed crimes, and somehow that was a shock. Then I did a book called Forever in 5 Days, which was about a couple of lesbian nurses in a nursing home that were murdering patients as part of a love bond. A lot of people thought, oh, that was too much, but that had done really well. So I wasn't afraid of, like, pushing the envelope with this one. But as I begin, when I do a book, the trial to me is nothing but kind of like a Rolodex of people to talk to. So I started interviewing, everybody, including all the kids and all that. And it just got darker and darker and darker, with babies being born in the house and buried in the backyard, and a bottomless pit of a pond where stuff was being thrown into, and sex. And it just got really nuts. And it actually got supernatural at some point. When he was murdering ordering the murder of this baby down in Florida, 3 of the other kids who were in different states in foster homes, because they'd been taking care of the family, all had the same psychotic break at the same time and were hallucinating their father in the room saying he was coming for them. I mean, this is stuff that just didn't make sense, by science. And it just got darker and darker and darker. And after 2 years of this, I started to feel like the whole world was just a kind of a crappy place. And, I kind of lost all faith in humanity. And I actually went into a clinical depression. And so when it came time to write the book, I managed to get out only like 20 pages in 3 months, and I'm usually 8 pages a day kind of guy. And then I called the publisher and said, I can't do it. And then I happened to see, not to make this story longer, but I happened to see Rod Steiger being interviewed about clinical depression. And I said, everything he was talking about, I said, geez, that's me. So I went and saw a doctor, got on antidepressants, wrote the book in 45 days. I felt like I was crawling out of hell with each page. Sent the book to the publisher and said, I don't want to hear about it. Here it is. Send me the check. I don't want to see it. I don't want to see the cover. I don't want to hear about it. I could get some blurbs for it. I'm done with it. I'm done with true crime. And a year and a half later, Google came along, and I Googled my own name like any good person did.
Yeah, ego surfing.
Ego surfing. And I say, Lowell Caulfield, New York Times. I'm going, what the hell is the New York Times writing about me? And I go, and I was on the New York Times bestseller list. I called the publisher and I said, why didn't you tell me I was on the New York Times bestseller list? And Paul Dennis, my editor, says, well, you said you didn't want to hear anything. So, I'm not invulnerable to it. You spend that much time seeing that much darkness, and eventually.
Do you remember the tipping point that took you into clinical depression? What part of that case that knocked, or the variety of parts of the case that just took you down?
It kind of crept up on me. But the interesting thing about this book, that everybody that was connected with it, that investigated it, had ended up having problems. It was like the true crime's version of the,
Bermuda Triangle?
No, the Curse of King Tut's Tomb.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The lead detective had two heart attacks. The social worker that was in charge of taking care of the kids had a heart attack and was sleeping with a gun in his pillow. The head of the Department of Social Services for Stark County in Ohio went into a clinical depression. And the woman who was very instrumental in rescuing one of the kids that ended up revealing all this ended up with a brain tumor and couldn't talk anymore. And so when I got hit, I thought, the curse continues. But no, I never saw it develop. I only realized how bad off I was until about a week and a half later, after I'd been on this stuff called Cerazone for a week. And I'm sitting in my house on a Saturday morning, and I noticed for the first time, the sun coming through the window. And I'm watching an old movie on AMC, and I thought, God, I haven't done this in years, And it was like coming out of an altered state. And that's the thing about depression. You don't even realize it's grabbing you.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to tell you, during it, the only thing that I liked to watch on TV was Crossfire, with people yelling at each other. It was the only thing.
Battling babies, as I call
it. Yeah, it was the only thing that would get me stirred up, And I was nasty, too. I was nasty to my family. I was cranky, and they'd had enough of me.
Yeah. Well, I've been there, done that.
Let's, for those that haven't read the book, just give us kind of a thumbnail of a little bit more than what you gave us about what this guy did, and then how it would get darker and darker, that it would affect everybody around the case to the point of, I've never heard of that many people going down in health.
What's the hell of a story?
Well, the story surrounded a guy named Eddie Lee Sexton, who had a nice home in the suburbs in Akron, Ohio, with 13 kids, and was known in the neighborhood as the kids were known as the best behaved kids in the neighborhood. And had this house with all the kids, and what people didn't realize was inside the house, the kids were being abused on a daily basis, tortured, paddled, whipped, sexualized. He was involved in it, his wife was involved in it, and then he started impregnating his daughters. And they were having babies, and in order to cover that up, he would get beards. He'd get a guy that, got this one guy named Joel, who was sort of semi-mentally handicapped, and he got him to marry his daughter.
As a cover for him.
Yeah, as a cover. And this went on for 15, 16 years until a very rebellious gal named Shelley, who was 15 years old, just got sick of all the beatings and the whippings, and fled, went to the Department of Social Services. So Department of Social Services goes to investigate him, and he pulls two or three of the kids out of the household, puts them in foster homes, and he jumps in a 24-foot motorhome with the rest of them. Oh, by the way, the reason he was impregnating his daughters, he was creating a super race called the Futuretrons. Whatever the hell they were. And a lot of the stuff was kind of biblical, satanic in nature. So he gets everybody in a motorhome, and they go on a cross-country crime spree. And they end up down in Florida, under a lot of pressure. And he orders the
death. Isn't the baby crying, and he tells his daughter, will you please, get that kid quiet? So she murders him.
Yeah. So she murdered him. And then as a result of that, Joel, the son-in-law, he orders the murder of him, and he gets his own son to murder him. He had a Manson-like control over everybody, except they just happened to be members of his own family as well. And
how the heck does that work?
Carrot and the stick, a lot of abuse. And the funny thing is I did a lot of shows afterwards, and I did the Lisa Gibbons show, and 2 hours on that show, and I was with a lot of the kids, and as the horrors they put him through and everything, Lisa Gibbons had arranged a prison interview with him that was fed into the studio, which I didn't even know was coming. And all of a sudden his picture appeared on the monitor inside the studio, you know, in front of this live audience, and these kids just absolutely transformed, like right in front of us all, like, oh, Dad, you know, I love you, Dad. And I mean, it was crazy. It's, you know, it, in retrospect, you know, and I take care of this at the end of the book, I consulted with one of the leading experts, I think it was from Harvard University, on father and daughter incest. And it was really actually a pretty classic case of an incestuous family. The reason there were 13 kids was you keep mom pregnant and barefoot all the time, so she can't mount any kind of
emotional or
rebellion. And she eventually joins in. He used satanic stuff in the Bible to control the kids. Some of the things involved satanic rituals, but the reason he used satanic rituals was that if any of the kids ever disclosed and went to social services and said, oh yeah, my dad's burning candles and has got skulls and we're slaughtering cats and goats and stuff like that, they'd go,
yeah,
the
right,
to the psychiatrist. You know, they wouldn't believe. So,
well, this guy was
Without even following up on the report and going out there and taking a look around, or
well, if they took a look around, they would find a really well-behaved family and kids that were nicely dressed.
He'd have it cleaned up before they got there.
No, absolutely. And I come to find out that that's in my research, I discovered that that's a big part of ritual abuse with the use of the satanic stuff. They're not really Satanists.
It's just a tool that they use.
13 kids and one couldn't get out and start yelling and screaming.
Well, one did, and that's that's what kind of broke open the dam. So
yeah, because I did a book where it was multi-generational incest, which it always tends to be. If you're from an incestuous family, even if you hated it, for some reason, it carries over. And whether it was from a legal standpoint in that book, of course, being as it was all involved, everyone was involved, that was a situation where everyone wasn't, where I had originally said you couldn't tell who was stupid who in the family without a chart and a graph and, you know, this sort of thing.
DNA test.
Yeah. And Paul, my editor at that time, said, we can't do that, because these people are peripheral to the crime story. You know, you don't want to say poor Sally here was getting stooped by her dad and the son was getting stooped by the mother and all these things, because it doesn't, you know, why embarrass these people unless they want to come forward and talk about it, which some of them did, but we had to...
But three out of the four of us have daughters.
Mm-hmm.
Burl, well, I can't even... I don't know.
Thank God you can't.
My mind doesn't go. I'm a bad guy sometimes. You know, but my God.
Yeah, I know. It's
my God.
It's like against your DNA.
I mean, it's...
It would never occur to you. One thing I learned the hard way is just because it wouldn't occur to me doesn't mean it doesn't occur to somebody else.
But yeah, I know that. But of course. And you know that, and you know that in your research as a writer. I mean, both of you guys are writers and research. But I don't have to research anything other than, you know.
Well, Howard, some people are just wired differently.
Wired.
This guy was damaged anyway. They did a PET scan on him, and he wasn't playing with the...
He was a psychopath, and he was a dirt poor psychopath. He was originally from West Virginia. And you know what they say about West Virginia people. You know, that's what my daddy and mommy met at a family reunion.
Yeah.
You know, but...
What did this guy do for...
Sorry, West Virginia.
...to support this family?
He was a master con man at getting Social Security, disability, filing lawsuits, burning down his own house, and filing for insurance. He was just sort of one of those, like, a master work-the-system kind of guy.
Yeah, if you look at a guy like that, just on that alone, you go, this guy needs to be put away. That's before he gets to...
At the trial, the defense attorney, I have it right here, defense attorney gets up in the opening statements and says, Eddie Sexton's a far cry from the All-American Father. You're going to hear evidence that he engaged in conduct before he was arrested in this case with his children. It could be considered reprehensible.
Possibly.
Yeah, possibly. You're going to learn he took liberties with his children that may cause you to ask yourself,
liberties?
Can this kind of thing really happen? Does it really go on? I'm here to tell you the evidence will show the Sexton family this did go on. This is a case about a very sick family. There'll be a lot of mud thrown at the man sitting behind me. Some of it true, some of it speculative, all of it ugly, all of it nasty, but none of it first-degree murder. And that's
so he was just going. This guy was just going for reduction. He knew the guy was gone.
Well, the point was, is did or didn't he say all these horrible things isn't what he's on trial for. He's on trial for murder.
Right.
So, and that's all we have to focus
on.
Yeah,
but he's pitching reduction right off the top.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he came out of the bullpen pitching reduction.
I'd say, well, you know.
Did he say innocent?
Oh, yeah, he said he didn't kill. He's not responsible for these murders. Yeah,
he's not responsible for the first degree. You know, the most curious phenomenon about the whole thing was, because a lot of investigation was still going on as I was involved in it, and the social workers, a great cop named Detective Reedy, the guy had the two heart attacks, and every stone we would lift up, we'd find something crazier and something more bizarre. Like he killed my favorite bunny and we had to all eat it, you know, and stuff like that. And we go, no, that didn't happen. And then
what's wrong with that?
And we would look back and think, yeah, but we didn't believe that other thing happened. And that happened. It just kept getting darker and darker and darker. At the end of the book, I talk about the bottomless pit. There came a point where they had this pond. And
kind of like the pool here in the back.
Yeah, and the detective is standing over the pond, and you know, the case is done. And he thinks, I should drain the pond, because who knows what the hell is down there, right? And he said, and then what am I going to find? When will it ever end? And he walked away from the pond, because it just, the darkness, it just got deeper and deeper and deeper, and it all turned out to be true.
But wasn't he kind of, didn't he have some sort of responsibility to drain that pond?
You could argue that, but you know, the perpetrator was on death row. And by the way, Eddie Lee Sexton, just this year, just a few months ago, died on death row. He cheated old Sparky. He was set for the electric chair, and just like he had cheated justice for all those years, he cheated us of the satisfaction of riding an electric chair to hell. So
he still got to go.
If you don't get punished here, you get punished sooner or later somehow.
Right.
Yeah, he was no sweetheart. When they went to do it, the sentencing phase, like, okay, the guy's guilty. What are the mitigating factors? So they bring him with a top, psychiatrists, they do the PET scans, CAT scans, dog scans, everything. And then what they discover is the mitigation wouldn't be mitigation. The decision was the guy is a sadistic sexual psychopath. Now, that's hardly a mitigating circumstance, you know. That if they revealed how bad he really was, it wouldn't be to his benefit.
You know, the interesting thing about, every book I've ever done, I always spend a lot of time with a killer. And I always spend a lot of time with the perpetrator.
Ralph!
Ralph's in trouble now, ladies and gentlemen. And during this commercial break, we'll be throwing him in the bottomless pit pond. We'll be right back with our guest, Lowell Caulfield, on True Crime Uncensored. There are some things in life that just don't go together. But listen to this. You take one drop-dead gorgeous woman. You add an incredibly wealthy, handsome man. You put them together. They have all the money, clothes, jewels, drugs, alcohol they could possibly want. Well, then you throw in a Glock 9mm handgun. It's all good fun until someone gets killed. Fatal Beauty, the shocking true story of beautiful Rhonda Glover, who put 13 bullets from a Glock 9mm into her boyfriend of 15 years, Jimmy Jost. Though she said he was abusive, the friend said he was passive. Either way, he was dead. Fatal Beauty, available January 2011 from Pinnacle True Crime by Burl Bear, living legend true crime author. And trust me, he's brilliant, I know it, because I am Burl Bear, author of Fatal Beauty.
If you own an iPhone or ride the plastic pony in front of Kroger, you are no longer tied to your computer. You are now free to roam and take Outlaw Radio with you everywhere you go. Grab an Outlaw Radio iPhone application, the smoking, drinking, interrupted, did I say interrupting? 24-hour party that you follow now follows you. Your iPhone is now the easiest way to stay connected with your friends at Outlaw Radio, like me. Change the way you listen to the radio 7 days a week, now available at the iTunes App Store.
And now, back to True Crime's
with Burl Bear and Don Woldman.
Don Woldman on the island of hiatus.
Don's gone.
Howard Lapidus is here.
Don's done.
Howard's eating chocolate chip cookies.
My favorite.
Fact checker Mark Boyer is here. Will Caulfield, famous true crime writer and television pilot maker, writer, producer, and filmmaker, and all sorts of weird stuff. Guy who escaped Detroit to come to L.A.
When did you leave Detroit?
About 8 years ago, 9 years ago.
Oh, so you were, oh, okay.
Yeah, because
I was there, the, in and out of there in the 70s.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But I'd stay on the Windsor side.
Yeah, smart choice.
Well, no kidding.
You could write a book about you, Howard.
No.
Sorry, Detroit. Ow!
Make you feel homesick?
It was a Saturday night.
I can hear Detroit now.
Yeah.
That's New Year's Eve.
Yeah. Did you know on New Year's Eve here, they shoot the bullets up in the air and forget that they come down?
Yeah, they forgot.
Detroit, too. Yeah, they literally bounce in the, on the pavement.
Yeah, they're bouncing to people's heads here, right. Unfortunately.
Right. So Will, you, when you do a book, you normally like to talk to the defendant, but in this case, you're telling me that you didn't want to talk to him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people used to ask me what I do, and I'd say I spend thousands of hours with people that most people I spend more than 5 minutes with.
Right.
And, you know, these little prison interview rooms where you can smell their cheap cologne and all this, and I would, usually with a perpetrator, I'll interview them once a week on a set schedule, run, you know, a couple hundred hours of tape, and they really get caught up in their lives doing that because they can't remember what they said 2 months earlier. And it always worked. But with Eddie Lee Sexton, I had no desire to talk to the man. Now, I had a lot of tape of him because he was making videos and sending them to Bill Clinton and Janet Reno and places like that.
Good audience, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm sure they were very sympathetic.
Yeah, yeah, well, he was talking about what a good family man he was. I did not have sex with my daughter. And, you know, that kind of thing. And I, you know, for legal reasons, I wrote him the letter and said, I'd like to talk to you. And he said he didn't want to talk to me, and I never pushed it. Whereas most other perpetrators, I would keep writing letters and actually convince
them. So you never spoke with this guy?
I didn't want to. No. I mean, I didn't need to.
Right.
What was he going to tell me that he had an argument?
Who was doing most of the talking for you? Who was filling in on this thing, other than with the case itself? Or who was your best interviewee?
Well, Shelley, the daughter who originally disclosed when she was, I think, 16 years old at the time, was a key source. But also his son, Eddie Lee Sexton Jr., some of the other kids, the detective, the prosecutor, neighbors. You know, when I build a book, I build it like a mosaic with multiple points of view from, you know, various people, and that's, to me, how you get to the truth. You know, everybody's got a different point of view, and see, you know, I mean, I can look across here and see Burl smoking a cigarette, and you can look over there and say, you know, he's killing himself, but both are different, but both are true, and books are kind of like that. If you put together a group point of view, you know, chapter by chapter, the full picture comes out. Because we're all colored by our perception. Mm-hmm. So I never use, like, one single source. I have many different sources. And then I also double-check what they say against documents and police reports.
Well, yeah, you can't necessarily believe what people tell you.
No.
And Rhonda Glover, who I wrote about in my book, Fatal Beauty, said, I have never been diagnosed with a mental illness. And you can get my medical records, and I'd like copies of them. Well, it was very easy to get because she had a competency hearing, so it was public record, all the previous stuff. Yeah, diagnose this. So I wrote back and said, if you want to know what your diagnosis is, I can tell you. She's one here.
Yeah, I like to confirm with at least two other sources, and if I'm unsure, I'll, you know, there'll be some attribution involved.
Were the children that actually committed the crimes physically, were they prosecuted also?
The son, Willie, who killed Joel, the beard, was prosecuted, but he was declared mentally incompetent. And
that's why he was picked as
right, because he was so.
What? He was picked as what?
Was this the guy who was?
He was. His father manipulated him into killing
right
the other one,
Joe. Right.
Yeah. And the daughter who smothered the baby, she I think she did 3 or 4 years is all, because, again, she was under duress. I mean, the kids were victims of this guy. So
his argument was that I didn't physically do it, right?
Yeah, it was like Manson. I mean, Manson never physically killed anybody. He had other people do it. The mother was also put away for child abuse and a bunch of other things, and I think she's still in prison.
Good place for him.
Did once the children that were directly involved in the crimes were released, were they able to get some kind of a semblance of a normal life, or they screwed forever?
Well, they were. You know, many of them went into foster families. You know, I would get reports, particularly the younger ones, that they were doing okay. And you know, most of the grown ones are doing okay. And I use that term loosely.
And relatively speaking.
I mean, it was a real challenge interviewing these folks. Like Shelley, one of my main sources, a daughter. I would drive 200 miles from Detroit down to Akron, where she lived, have an interview set up, and I'd get to her house. Her car would be there, and she wouldn't come to the door because she was having a bad day. And I'd look through the window, and she'd be in the fetal position on her bed, you know. And the next day, she'd be perfectly fine. So, I mean, that was one of the challenges of the book, too, because the older kids were still kind of traumatized by this whole thing.
Any of them try to hold you up for cash?
One of the uncles did.
Yeah.
And I gave him an offer he couldn't refuse, which was, I'm writing about you anyway.
That's right.
You can choose to take part or not.
I had two brothers who gave me fabulous information, but I kept not receiving back the permission form. So I got to have this permission. Then they wanted to hold me up for money. And I said, hey, we don't get a research budget on these things, and this isn't checkbook journalism. I'm going to write the story. But I couldn't quote them. I had all this great stuff. Fortunately, their elder sister got hold of me and said, if they're not going to own their own lives, you know, they're never going to heal from this. Whatever they said, you can attribute it to me, and she signed the...
Well, you know what I do. I don't want to embarrass people or humiliate people, so I tell them, look, if this is too humiliating, we can create a pseudonym for you. You know, we noted it's not your real.
How is this not humiliating to anybody in this case? I mean, seriously, the kids, how, even the wife.
Well, the odd thing about it was the kids all wanted their name in the book. You know, that was kind of weird.
But it was humiliating.
Yeah. But I mean, if you've got somebody who is reluctant, you know, I'm willing.
Well, they're probably, you know, a little narcissism from the father is seeping through the gene pool.
You know, this one I can't even figure out what's going on. It's like, you know, it's like interviewing the DSM-4, you know, diagnostic statistical manual, psychiatric disorders. There were so many things I ran into.
None of them can be normal. Did I answer your question? This is just my guess, Mark. Yeah. But none of them can be walking around fine.
Well, that's like in the case I was talking about earlier, where the mother was a victim of extreme sexual abuse by her father. The husband also had come from a similar background. Their only goal was to have a nice, normal family. They marry. They have 9 kids. Each of the 9 kids either married a child molester or was a child molester.
Yeah, it's a...
Well, that's what happens.
Yeah.
That's like alcoholism, same thing, you know. People tend to go to what they're familiar with. Although I have talked with some of the kids, to answer your questions, and they're doing surprisingly well. I mean, I talked to Eddie Lee Jr. a while ago, and he's gotten on with his life, and all of them...
What's he doing? What's he doing?
What is he physically doing?
Well, when you say he got out of his life, what does that mean?
Well, I don't think he's running around
killing people.
No, that's
about,
a plus.
No, I'm
right
talking
there.
About the son. You know, I mean.
Oh, I know who it is. Yeah,
but he's. I don't think he's living in the mindset as a victim. You know, he's
okay.
He's not going to let it. Right. You know, stop having a family.
Has to answer. Yeah,
everyone's got their demons. It's whether you got them or they got you.
Did anybody go to this guy's funeral? Any of the kids?
I don't know.
Was there a funeral?
I don't know. Like I said,
big memorial service.
Oh yeah, all of his friends showed up. The ones that were dead.
I don't want anything to do with the case unless it's got my name on it. I sign it. I can deposit it.
Okay.
The 20th printing, you know, I just got my check in the mail.
20 printings over here. You have to go somewhere. There's a couple of questions you might be interested in.
I'm just giving you a hard time.
Yeah, I know you are. And I'll give you one right back. It's all right.
Well, you stopped eating cookies, didn't you?
I did. I had four cookies.
So this gentleman and I both had the same mentor, same good buddy, Jack Olson, who was known as the Dean of True Crime, the American Treasure. Brilliant, brilliant author. His book, and I'm going to plug this, ladies and gentlemen, because it's such an incredible book. His book on Geronimo Pratt, Last Man Standing, I think is one of the finest books I've ever read in my life.
My mentor was Jimmy Hills.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Thank you, Clark.
Yeah.
From the Adventures.
Yes. Yeah. We know that. Great Caesar's here, ghost.
Yeah. Pardon me?
Lannis joined us.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back after we allow our local stations to identify themselves and we have a sales pitch from a product you definitely want. We'll be right back. Barbara Opel promised her 14-year-old daughter a brand new dirt bike if she'd murder her employer. You know that. It's my book,
Mom Said Kill.
The kid didn't get the dirt bike. Well, guess what? The book is now available as a digital download from Barnes & Noble. Mom Said Kill by Burl Bear, the new digital edition. And you know what? Even in the digital edition, the kid still doesn't get the dirt bike. Mom Said Kill by me, Burl Bear, and I love me to pieces.
If you own an iPhone or ride a plastic pony in front of Albertsons, you are no longer tied to your computer. You are now free to roam while Barstow's burning and take Outlaw Radio with you everywhere you go. Grab an Outlaw Radio iPhone application, the smoking, drinking, interrupting 24-hour party that you follow now follows you. Your iPhone is now the easiest way to stay connected with your friends at Outlaw Radio. Change the way you listen to the radio 7 days a week, now available in the iTunes App Store.
Yes, of course. Burl Baron. I've known a few writers who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
I'm still the legendary Burl Bear. Howard Lapidus is still Howard Lapidus. Mark Boyer is still Mark Boyer. And Lowell Caulfield, author of House of Secrets, down his 20th printing, and several other books as well. A true journalist. One, he's a real journalist, Howard. I want to point this out to you.
I get that.
He's not a blogger. This guy's a real journalist.
No, he's a journalist and a writer, and so are you. And I'm, guy that was, I said, basically just to try and get through talking about a case like this, we're laughing my ass off. And we're, we were kind of laughing during the commercial break and just before the commercial break, and Will brought up, why are we laughing about this?
It's a mechanism of dealing with something that isn't comprehensible.
Well, it's not comprehensible.
Yeah, and, the key to any cop shop, when you're investigating as a investigative journalist is you've got to have a sense of humor when you walk into those homicide sections because it's a coping mechanism. And it gives you a little bit of that detachment because if you actually really sat down and deeply thought about what was going on, which is what eventually happened to me on House of Secrets, you
just go,
the onion begins to peel. And you go, what am I doing here? What's wrong with me? Which brings up a really good question. Why do people read true crime?
Why do you write true crime?
And why do we write about true crime?
Well, no, hang on. You write about true crime. What's the answer?
Well, I read about true crime for the same... Well, I wrote about true crime for the same reason people read about true crime. I think that true crime is a litmus test for people to check their morality. In other words, when they see a story like the Casey Anthony story or read one of Burl's books or one of my books, they're really looking into themselves and making a comparison as to how they are different.
Or better than.
Better than, or maybe even worse than the people in the book. And what are the triggers that cause the people that are in the books or on the shows, to become, for example, homicidal? Because we all know that we have a dark side to some extent. We all do crazy stuff. What's our
tipping point?
Yeah, our boundaries. Where are our own boundaries? So I think when we read these books, we're looking at our own boundaries. And in a sense, it's tabloidish in that sense. The great tabloid formula is knock down the high and mighty and exalt the weak. And true crime kind of falls within that.
It also depends on the economics. Most of my books are about blue-collar crimes, and then our publisher got hold of me and said, you know what, the economy the way it is, this is going back a few years when things started to tip, the readers, our research shows, they want to read about, again now, like what they used to, rich people who are all screwed up.
It's the bonfire of the vanities. I mean, that, right. That always sells.
And I want to answer your question, Mark, as to why I write about that's what got
Mark here. That's Mark. How are you?
Yeah, how it's okay. Okay.
I've wanted to be a Mark.
Yeah, you've been one a few times.
Howard. It's fun, Howard.
What got me into it is my first book, Masqueraded True Story, Seduction, Compulsion, and Murder. I had just gotten sober. I've been you know, in recovery and sober for 26 years now. But I was about a year sober at the time, and I was looking back at all the crazy stuff I did when I was drinking and doing a lot of exploration of various Bolivian and Peruvian substances. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mother of Pearl opalescent.
Yeah, right, right. It got the way of telling me I was making too much money. Yeah. And when I came across a case about a man who was obsessed with a prostitute and created a double life for himself, a psychologist in Detroit, ended up murdered and dismembered, but he had had this compulsion that he couldn't stop, I kind of related to that. I thought, how was he, you know, he was addicted to this girl, I was addicted to alcohol and drugs, how come he's dead and I've survived? And so it was kind of an exploration of myself in investigating him. That helped clear things up for myself.
So what did you find out about yourself?
He's alive.
I know he's alive, but how dark did you think, how dark would you have gone?
I'm not going to have to pay $300 an hour for this answer, am I?
It's five.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, right, inflation.
Right. We're in LA.
No, that's $5.
No, it's $500.
I think what I found is that I really didn't know myself, and I always felt a little detached from the rest of the world, and my insides didn't match other people's outsides, and to fill that gap, drugs and alcohol in particular, was my medicine. It made me feel normal. I mean, I never drank to get drunk and go pee on somebody's couch or sleep with some guy's wife. I did it because it made me feel normal.
You'd still pee on people's couches.
Well, yeah. I mean, who doesn't?
So, and then the biggest thing I learned in recovery was that the alcohol is only a symptom, that I had to, you know, I had to find a spiritual center for myself to...
Well, 26 years, you've done that.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering, how far would you have gone?
Well, no one knows how far they would go.
Yeah, so is that what you look at, Burl? I mean, do you dance with that?
Well, I think, you know, someone was talking about, and we don't get into politics on the program, but the that the same qualities and attributes of risk-taking, ego, confidence, smarts that get a politician into a position of influence and can do things are the exact same qualities and attributes that on a negative side can get him in trouble. It's like wind or the Holy Spirit. Or it can blow you out to sea or can blow you to the rocks.
Your assets are your greatest liabilities.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Anthony Weiner. I mean,
that's the example we're using.
You know, while we're at the other big story this week, I have a theory that the reason that these guys self-destruct is because unconsciously they want to.
That's like to say the reason people smoke coke while they're driving is they want to get caught.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, for me, my behavior got more and more outrageous. I wanted to see, like, how far could I push it, you know, before I completely disgusted myself. And in the case of somebody like Weiner or some of these politicians, these guys live in a world of lies and BS and manipulation. And I really think a guy like Weiner was so... showed such lack of caution, you know, by tweeting strangers and all this stuff, that he was really kind of reaching out like, somebody stop me.
Well, there's a term for what Weiner did. I mean, took me a while to get to it.
Stupid.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Stupid. Yeah, here's a guy, quite frankly, politically, I thought it was pretty sound. You know, I've been following his career for a long time, and would say things that were, you know, fairly
consistent with how you felt or what you thought were the wise things to do.
I can pick him and John Edwards. You wonder, hey, you look at all these guys, Schwarzenegger, Clinton, how do these guys do this?
Well, but, taking addiction, for example, it's not a function of being smart or being dumb. I mean,
they're not stupid people who need to be educated. They're not,
about addiction, we can start talking about genetics. That's not what we're talking about here, I don't think.
Well, now we're talking about compulsive behavior.
Yes.
And obsessive behavior. And it overrides any amount of intelligence.
Here's a guy, he's got an office on Capitol Hill, and he's got people in this and that, constituents back in New York, and he's churning papers and churning good stuff all the time. And then he goes home, takes his shirt off, and whips it out and says, it on Twitter.
And who can blame him? It's probably good stress relief for him. But, I mean, he didn't mean to send it out to everybody.
It
makes sense to me.
At what point is the camera at your crotch? Do you go, wait a minute, a little to the left, a little to the left,
But you're trying to apply rational thinking to irrational compulsions and impulses.
Yeah. Right. People are going to do what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Aren't you noticing, Howard Lapidus, if it's a Democrat, this man, Burl Bear, will justify his every action.
Magic Matt
way,
Allen, ladies and gentlemen. Magic Matt Allen,
you
just in
that.
From the right.
I heard it in your voice.
Yeah.
I'm a conservative, too, I'm with you.
It's like, Burl, how can you justify this idiot's
freaking... I can't justify it.
No, you aren't. Burl is. He's trying his...
Burl,
I can identify with the guy.
You only show your...
Are you insane?
I mean, I give you an argument.
Hang on a second. I'm as to the left as anybody, but are you nuts? I mean, are you insane?
Well, my theory is, if this were France, where Jerry Lewis is very popular,
stop it.
They wouldn't care about this.
Why did you bring Jerry Lewis and France into this?
Well, this kind of thing has nothing to do with left or right.
It makes a great distraction. It makes a great distraction.
It has nothing to do with in any form.
Of course, it is. Right,
especially
left,
when the guy's
center.
Married to such a hottie.
Well, that's your opinion.
She's smart. Anyway, the guy shouldn't be doing that stuff when he's married. If he's not married, someone wants his picture.
Oh, married, schmarried over here.
Married, schmarried. Why? You're sending pictures
that
when you're married.
Wasn't one of the individuals underage that got between?
No.
What's that?
No.
No.
I have a whole theory about marriage. Having done it a couple of times. Maybe you agree.
Because he's married, that's the reason?
I didn't
How
say
about
that.
The fact that he's a congressman, you idiot?
Well,
then
that's where we're at.
Save
this for the other
show. He shouldn't be doing
Hang
that.
On a second.
No,
Matt.
No, because he's married.
Matt, save this for
but
the other show.
It's not about that. If he's not,
save
if
this
he's
for the other. Say this goes on the
Hey, guess what? When you become executive producer of this show, you can tell me what to do, Howard.
I'm a damn good executive producer.
Yeah. Speaking of compulsions,
that mic's not on. They got
this lighter. You lucked out on that.
Yeah, I lucked out on that.
Burl, stop being such a predictable liberal.
Hey, if you can't be a predictable liberal, why bother?
So what are you...
When you have to shoot, don't talk.
Well, what are you working on now?
As the right-wing extremist here...
you don't look bad.
Are you actually trying to get back to...
You're liberal compared to Vic, trust me.
I have a whole bunch.
Are you trying to get back to...
Reinforcements are coming
soon. Yes, I am.
Reinforcements.
Forget it.
Reinforcements are coming soon.
Look, here's what happened. Here. We're talking about the most gruesome of murders in a long, long time.
Yeah.
And we had enough of it. So now we're having fun. We're talking about
Anthony Weiner. Trying to move on.
Well, what I'm working on now is next month I'm directing a short film. I've got a nonprofit production company called Primary Purpose Productions, and we do scripted films that are entertaining about actually addiction issues, but they're not on the nose. They're
kind of
oblique. They're, so to speak. You know, they're geared towards engaging people in either humor or drama or sci-fi or the different genres we work with, but they each have a recovery message in them. And I've got Kurtwood Smith in the lead. He's a great actor. You may remember from RoboCop, one of the bad guys in RoboCop. He was on the 70s show. He's just a total pro. And Dastan Khalili, another great actor, playing another part. And interesting, the setup of the film is it's set in 1958, and the great psychologist B.F. Skinner, played by Kurtwood Smith, is running his rat experiment, like, you know, with rats in a box that run over grids to get the reward, except the box is full size and it's a human being inside. So it's sort of a Twilight Zone kind of thing.
I was going right there. Yeah, it felt very Twilight Zone.
It appears like a normal science experiment.
Or Saw. A little bit like Saw. You know?
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. I
prefer Serling. He was a professor of mine, so I prefer him. I like him a lot.
So you're also working on pilot season?
Yeah, pilot season is coming up. I'll be out pitching to the networks.
Screw pilot season.
Hey, every time pilot season comes around,
so
my
nephew makes money. Executive producer who's already got one up.
There are four.
Four? Yeah, okay, four up. Yeah, screw everybody else. It's all mine.
Hey, I got one. I got one coming up.
Well, yeah.
Save New Orleans starts shooting September 7th in New Orleans.
Oh, awesome.
With James Purefoy in the lead.
Uh-huh.
And directed by Ron Shelton, who did Bull Durham. And
is it a film?
It's a two-hour TV movie. It's the first, the debut episode of the intended series.
Is it based on one of your cases?
Based on The Saint, The Robin Hood of Modern Crime, The Devil with Dames, The Headache of Cops and Crooks Alike. You know, Roger Moore did the series. And Ian Ogilvy was on the show a couple weeks ago, did Return of the Saint, and it's a new Saint show.
Nobody saw that. Oh, yeah, and I'm only quoting.
Yes, he says no one saw it.
Well, he's not terribly wrong.
No, but this is a tragic thing, right? Show about show business.
Burl, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Have you ever had, psychological impact from some of the stuff?
Look at
him. No.
Look at
this man.
Hey, what do you think?
Burl is just naturally.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, he's standing behind a bar, a fully stocked bar behind him, and he's chain-smoking cigarettes. He's completely normal.
Yes. No, actually, I had an episode like you did, except it wasn't related to the book. I hadn't written my first true crime book yet. It was just before I did my first one. But I was working for a buddy of mine at a radio station in Walla Walla, Washington, and we had several stations actually. One of them was a talk station, and it had Rush Limbaugh and it had Oliver North, and I was doing the on air and also doing sales. And I'm driving to go to a sales pitch, and I'm listening to Oliver North, and his special guest that day was Pat Buchanan, the Holocaust denier. And I pulled over to the side of the road, and went, I can't do this. I cannot do this. And call the psychiatrist. I'm falling apart. I cannot, in good faith, go out and say, hey, put your dollars on, I just totally fell apart. And
well, that had nothing to do with true crime.
Well, no, then
bad
the,
radio.
Bad radio, yeah. And or maybe good radio, but...
And he got a couple of political shots in there, too, in case you didn't know.
Well, it was the Holocaust denying that got me. But that always rubs me the wrong way. But when I worked on my first...
How do you know there was a Holocaust?
How do I know? Well, how about the friends and relatives with the numbers on there? That wasn't the universal pricing code.
Oh, it was a scan technique.
Yeah, right.
You got it out of the grocery store faster with the number.
Yeah, it was the same people that did the 9/11 conspiracy.
Yeah, they did that, yeah. Anyway, so when I did
Kennedy
my first
assassination
one,
guys, yeah. Those guys.
We did have on Bron Bear Tyler, who finally came forward after many years that his dad planned the MLK assassination, and he delivered the rifle. And they've been spending years now doing all the backup, all the whatever, and Aaron Moriarty got hold of me and said, is this real? And I said, yep, they got all the backup on it. And so she's been following up on that. It's a fascinating story.
Well, the conspiracy theory stuff is a function of a kind of a, it's a social phenomenon from everything I've read about it, in that people see these things, these dramatic things happen in their life, and they can't set a simple explanation, like, Lee Harvey Oswald or... a dozen terrorists with box cutters. So they've got to make the run up equal the drama of the thing.
The first known one, actually, was the first conspiracy theory was the Black Plague. And the theory was that it was the Jews, the Muslim king of Morocco, or whatever it was, and the lepers. And that was the triune conspiracy
theory. Burl Bear, tell your esteemed guests. You believe O.J. Simpson is not guilty.
I believe O.J. Simpson's not guilty.
Now, more than that, because he was found not guilty, but no, you believe that he was not responsible for
it. You've got to be kidding me, Burl.
No, actually, I'm not. And there's a...
Burl, I've covered 100 homicide trials that had less evidence than they had against O.J., and they were all convicted.
Burl!
Isn't that amazing?
Burl, what bus did you take to get here?
The one that goes down Bundy.
Yeah. Not Ted Bundy, either. I do have, you know, Kevin Sullivan sent Don and I pieces of Ted Bundy's hefty bag that he kept his stuff in, his kill kit.
That's just the part that didn't, lovely, that didn't go to the Smithsonian.
How much did you sell that for on eBay?
On eBay? Nah, not as much as I'd like.
Let's say goodbye to our guest and thank him very much.
Thank you, guest, very much. Oh, Lowell thank Caulfield, again, his 20th printing, House of Secrets. Buy several copies because in 6 months he gets another check.
You guys are a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Thanks. Magic Matt Allen, the Demons of Decadence, live from the Lighten Up Lounge. Got hurt. Oh, come on. Go for it.